Hi Internet, my name is John Matos.
And this is Melissa Matos.
Welcome to Unboxing Story, where we unpack fiction with... I lost it in the middle there.
Without the friction.
There you go. Good layup there. Help your brother out. I wanted to open up with an apology. I didn't get up the... We're not very prescriptive about talking about what our schedule was. But we have a perceived schedule.
Yes.
An agreed upon schedule. And I didn't get the Dark Crystal episode up. But it is a banger, if I can call it that.
Banger.
Because I just remember
I ranted a lot.
I've been...
A lot of ranting.
Well, like, I feel as though the love for Muppets has been roiling under the surface. And we, like, let it free. So, that's what that was. And now, something kind of similar... But today's episode, been kind of a movie that I've been fascinated with for quite a while. I discovered it in my Irish literature class, and a lot of my literature.
You got to watch that for Irish literature?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so jealous.
Hey, it was interesting, my literature classes, because we would have, texts to go over, but then, for example, in my, I don't know, my composition class or what, but. We were talking about tragedy, and we watched United 93.
Oh, wow.
And so, like, they really viscerally tried to get us to understand what happens when you consume a certain type of, cultural artifact. So it wasn't necessarily trying to pigeonhole that as just a from-text thing. And similarly, like, this really hit me as, like, a very almost provincial... romance. But what's interesting is that because I feel like the 90s and early 2000s created this like formula for what romance is, there's a lot of very subtle things that it does to just blow that out of the water. So the one thing that we brought up is that like the friendship kind of becomes what the thing is about.
Yeah.
And romance is the subject of the movie.
Right.
But it subverts your expectations of the main couple being, part of this formulaic romance story. I don't know how specific we'll get in this episode about what happens at the end, but it is very much analyzing the realities of romance in, these two younger adult, lives. Let's talk a little bit about kind of like the drama of it, but how it avoids... kind of melodramatic stuff, because we start with like this guy that's heartbroken, and they're very good at making that like sad,
yeah.
But like
you just start with this not very well dressed dude on the side of the street singing for money, can't talk, with this poor sad beat up guitar that made me cry.
this poor woman in this.
It's got a hole in the front and it's beat up and it's a shame. Oh my goodness. Anyway. But like, you obviously know he's in a bad place and he's sad because he's singing and very well singing these like heart-wrenching songs. And you could feel like the pain in his voice. Like it's just there.
I kind of mentioned that like, my musical education is far less classical than my sister's. And so, like, discovering somebody like that, that really shows not just through his lyrics, but through how painful, like, his heartbreak, whatever he's thinking about, whether it was something like the movie interpretation of it, or, that was more fictionalized than not. You hear him singing and you get that something happened.
And then we get a very, very well fleshed out female character. Because, like, usually, my brother was pointing out, you get the story from one side or the other. And so the main character tends to be more fleshed out than the love interest in those cases. But this one felt a lot more like the kinds of things I like, where you get full pictures of both people and they find each other. Like, it's not just, I found that person, and that person's going to make my life better. It's like, no, both of these people needed something and found that in the other person.
Right. And I tend to think of it as, you know, things that are written from the perspective of the protagonist is like, you're thinking, okay, so the person that he's in love with is like this antagonist that he has to win over. And so it kind of sets it up where he's heartbroken over this girl. And I kind of brought up one of the criticisms of the type of romance story that this is, where there's a very spirited young woman that comes into your life and they're prefabricated as if to fill the void of
right.
this male character for a certain period of time. And I feel like it's a misunderstanding of this formula of storytelling where there has to be, in every romance story, a culmination by the end of it. We kind of talked a little bit about that after watching it's a British film, I forget the Christmas movie, where there's like 50...
Oh, Love Actually?
Yeah. That's one cool thing about that, is that they show different love relationships, not all of which are romantic,
right.
Some of which are very romanticized and whirlwind, but some that are kind of like, you know, this person is somebody that has been cheated on, and that they're still willing to patch up the relationship as long as that, like, gets kiboshed, and, like, there's all these different things that they really suck you in with. But they're not schmaltzy romances that that you might be more used to if you're looking at romance as this one version of this type of story. And I think this does a good job of really playing your heartstring, but subverting a lot of those expectations.
Actually, I was just thinking now too, we can talk a little bit about comparing this to something like A Star Is Born, which, at least the new one, I thought was, I mean, obviously the music was great, but I really didn't like how that went at all. Like, in this one, you know both people are in hard times, but they are still good people, and they're working their hardest to do what they can. They're not going to let their family down. They're not going to give up on their principles out of nowhere just to be with this other person, or for their music even. Because they're trying to do well with this music, but they're not, like, stealing money to go pay for their CD or anything like that. Like, they're trying to do the honorable thing to get what they want.
And it feels very cathartic. We're going to kind of get into the poverty, the levels of poverty that are portrayed in this. But I'll say one of the things that makes something like A Star Is Born much more unrelatable to me personally is that it very much romanticizes this level of stardom.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the stricture of the original story that I forget his name, but the actor that both directed and starred in that.
Bradley Cooper,
yeah. In trying to adapt this story that's more about success than it is a relationship, or at least you can say the relationship is sacrificed for this level of success,
yeah.
Where, like, that is the culmination. It's, well, at least she got to this level of success. You have varying degrees of whether that feels good at
right.
the end of it.
Right.
Because,
and the thing, and I don't know, I haven't seen the other versions, if they all end with the male lead giving, committing suicide, but the idea that he also had that level of success and it wasn't enough for him, and he still had this horrible self-destructive thing going on. And I don't even remember if they give an explanation as to why he was that self-destructive. Like, did he have some tragic thing in his past that he was trying to not feel anymore? Or is he just always like that? Like, not that I'm trying to downplay that is a real mental problem. But at the same time, it was almost like this glorification of that.
Yeah, there's something about the stylistic choices that make it seem like, as long as my love gets a hit song out of this,
right, then I'm okay if I, like, kill myself later.
And it's kind of, I kind of associate it with a Bruce Springsteen type ethos that you get from some of our folk music, and that there's this, like, beautiful tragedy type thing
right.
that's romanticized, And I think that there are some elements in it that are toxic and that don't, in a film, translate into a very satisfying ending.
Right.
And so I think this is a good example of something where you see that this person lives in a tenement with one television. It had a child very early. I can't. This woman is Czech, so I can't rightly say her name.
No, I can't say it either. I'm not even gonna try.
You know, they show all these different things, and it's interesting because I would kind of place it tonally between something like Roma, which focused a lot on specific slice of life instances of reality.
Right.
And something like A Star Is Born, where they want to romanticize this dream of becoming a successful musician.
Right.
But it's
and
kind
it
of
managed to hit the good balance in between.
Yeah.
Because you still see the reality of her living in, you know, all sleeping in the same room, mm-hmm. and they have little dividers between their beds, mm-hmm. and, like, the dudes next door come over to watch TV all the time, and it's no big deal. Yeah. But, like, you still see that she has this hope in her family, this hope in her talent, mm-hmm. and this hope in this new person that she met,
right.
to be like, no, it's okay, things are gonna get better, or even if they don't, we're all right now, like, mm-hmm. I'm surviving.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, the beautiful music helped you feel all fuzzy.
Yeah, and I was going to bring that up, that, like, even though this doesn't have the trademarks of, like, I would say the nearest thing to this to come out recently is La La Land.
Yeah.
Where you're trying to update the musical for today's sensibilities, and I think that did a good job of making a traditional Hollywood feeling musical without, you know, doing too many unrelatable callbacks or things just for the sake of
right.
doing this old style thing. Whereas in this, like, there is, I kind of think of it as, like, style over theme, where, like, there was this underlying feeling of searching for hope, different thematical elements that come through in different songs. But it was more or less kind of like a Joycean, like, stream of conscious thing.
Right.
Where you're taking this journey with them. It's one reason I really like when the girl, I think, I'm gonna say that her first name sounds like Mia. But I'm just going to refer to in the credits they just call her girl. So
yes,
I'll say girl.
I'm just girl. It is literally guy and girl.
When
they
do that thing of, like, I can't, like, I don't have, not that you can't afford it. Well, she doesn't have money, so she takes money out of her kid's piggy bank and gets batteries for her Walkman. But there's this way in which the contrast of that little, like, moment shows this diligence with her art, and it kind of ties this very mundane thing of, like, going to get batteries to when she's walking back to her apartment singing to herself. There's some romantic feeling that you get with her just walking
yeah.
in the street. And it's an interesting thing because, you know,
I've watched too many thrillers because I kept expecting her to get jumped or something on my own.
That this
terrible.
Was, yeah, going to get Rob Grizzly. It still has that feeling that they, you know, it for some reason, with La La Land, it still feels like a musical.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, it felt like, I'm looking through a window into this person's artistic life.
Yeah. I actually like how you said you compared it to more like a documentary. It felt more like a documentary of, here's how this person got their start.
Right.
And then showed you, okay, started on a street corner, and then he met this amazing person, and they made music together, mm-hmm. and that inspired him to finally get on it off his butt and do the recording, mm-hmm. and then they made it. Uh-huh. And, you know, like, it's just, it was a neat, it felt almost like a documentary more than a film, really.
Yeah. I think after the break, I'll talk a little bit about more comparisons to Joyce, because I think there's a little bit more there, and something that kind of connects to someone I met recently at the a novel idea on Pasio, who did a reading, and his version of nonfiction, I think, is kind of like this. So look forward to that after the break. So, we had kind of talked about how there's different speculative writing that feels more to us like magical realism. And I feel like that's still a genre that people, like, enjoy playing around with. But David Olympio, who I met at the community drafts last Friday, he called a portion of his collection speculative nonfiction. And I feel like that kind of is what some literary fiction authors like James Joyce try to get across in experimenting with language, and that, like, they want to translate their lived-in experience through the style of their work, right? And so, you know, James Joyce specifically uses stream of consciousness to try to achieve that. But I feel like there's the guerrilla style filmmaking in this. I think some of the stuff that I'm used to seeing are more like French New Wave filmmaking, where it's off-putting on purpose, and it makes you not very interested in delving into it, because it seems like there's some kind of, like, secret thing that they're trying to get you to decode.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, it was very much like, I mean, you can feel very raw, and, like, I'd say that there was a really raw part for me where he's watching the films of his ex-girlfriend, where I'm just like, okay, I feel like I'm in the room with him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're having a moment. I don't know if I should be here when you're experiencing all this. But, like, it kind of has that feeling to me of you're trying to get in their head and feel like them, and that like, one thing I noticed is that there were no real establishing shots.
Right.
Where I feel like a lot of American films, if you're trying to get the feeling of, like, being a teenager in a high school, they'll do, like, the bell ringing outside of the school.
Right.
And there's this kind of omniscience to it. And so that kind of, I liked that about the film, that it was having these little peaks. And
right. It felt more like there was just a bunch of cameramen, like, hanging out in their house, like a reality show, almost, where you're just there, and, like, yeah, we're just gonna keep rolling, and we'll cut this together later and figure out what looks good and what doesn't. Like, this is just, you know, because they had, like, scenes of her cleaning her house and stuff that was not really necessarily relevant to this is their search for their success in music, but this is what her life is, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it was kind of almost that feeling, not quite, obviously, because it wasn't, but it felt like that.
Yeah, and I think I want to get a little bit into the third party characters. I'm always referring to it like a campaign. They're not non-playable characters, but they're
totally the NPCs, John. Yeah. That's exactly what that is.
Well, you would think that with the traditional literary thing of, like, you get this omniscience, and so you think that helps you populate a world more richly. But in actuality, I feel like the guerrilla filmmaking of it makes it feel like these are actual people.
Right.
And you get more of a rich idea of them as characters. So, like, for example, you were kind of talking about there are these buskers that they run into that they're just like, hey, do you want to record with us?
Right.
And I feel like I knew them, even though you're just meeting them randomly. And some of that is, like, a little bit of the dialogue, where it's like, you know, is it any good? Like, different things about it that seem more, like, flippant and, like, what somebody would say in the moment. It made me wonder whether this was
partly improvised or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the best one was when, after they record, he says something like, why do you think there are no blonde priests?
Yeah. You're like, what?
And it has nothing, like, it hard cuts.
I'm assuming
cuts.
There was a punchline, but they don't, yeah, but you don't
yeah.
see it.
It hard cuts to her in the hallway, and so it's like, you know that there's not anything about that line, so it seems just like they're trying to set up, yeah, after, like, days and days of recording.
After, you know, 12 straight hours of making music, you're a little loopy.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. I liked the way, that scene that felt like that, too, where the three guys just walk in to watch TV. Like, it's almost like the cameramen were hanging out and thinking, oh, we're going to have this nice, cute dinner with them and the family. And then all of a sudden some random neighbors just pop into the house and you're like, but that's how it felt. It's like, that's what the guy was feeling like. He was just like, who are these guys? And why are they just randomly coming in to watch your television? Like, what is happening?
And to say that, they do a good job of between the directing and the, you know, the choices that the different performers made to show reactions that are understated, but a combination of that angle and just a slight choice on the actor's part showed that, like, for example, when that happens, he's, like, not used to being in an apartment where people just randomly come in to watch your television. And so he was, like, kind of put off by that. But then by the end, the film kind of makes you feel like they're just her normal.
Yeah, these are just some friends.
When you have one television in your tournament, how are you going to get by? You know? And it does that a lot with different, like, different things to try to get to tease you a little bit with will they, won't they? Is that, like, there's different looks that they give each other, and it's very subtle, but you invest a lot into those small moments. Like, they go to this really nice party where, and nice to me because it's just a bunch of people
singing
and eating.
They went to a Bardic Circle, guys.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
You know, all you need is just one shot of her in the background looking at him while he's singing.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you're filling in the blanks.
Right.
Kind of.
So this gives me hope that John might actually enjoy watching Pride and Prejudice. Because it's a very similar sort of understated, you know, desire between two people.
Right. And I feel like to your credit and all the Austin fans before you, there is a what would you call it? A stereotyping of the different schools of romance.
Yeah.
And I think that there are different tropes that have different baggage to them. And it's something that I started to consider a little bit more seriously after watching Lindsay Ellis' video on Twilight, because she was saying, what is it about a fantasy for women that scares society more than fantasy for men? And it was interesting because she kept saying, like, I'm not saying that Twilight is the most bestest of the fantasies, but it is still a fantasy that is more for women than it is for men.
Yeah.
And you don't see people storming the streets about Transformers, where she was more on the in the drama wheel, if you want to call it, about, like, specifically Stephenie Meyer being attacked for different choices she made,
right.
As opposed to the more dry academic criticism that somebody like Michael Bay gets for a Transformers type thing. So, as much as I like to, with everybody else, like, laugh at something like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, there is something to be said about showing, for example, like, how much ownership this character has over this romance that's happening. And it seems like you were impressed by that. So if you want to dig in.
So the amount of respect shown between the two of them was impressive. It wasn't about the guy pushing to make this relationship happen, which is always good anyway. Cause if you're coming at it from the guy's side and it's just like, oh, I'm going to get this girl to be with me, it's annoying to me personally, unless you're Cary Grant, which most people are not. I don't like watching that part. It was the girl who initiated it. Cause she's the one that came up and is like, so what are you doing? Like, why are you sitting on the street corner singing these songs? Obviously, A, you have a broken heart, and B, you're an amazing musician, so you should, like, be doing more than singing on the street corner. Like, she was the one that helped, you know, get him moving. But they didn't make it the whole, what do you call it, the Manic Pixie Dream Girl thing, where that's all she's doing. Like, he also was helping her to get noticed and to get, you know, her music out there. and was trying to show her that her music was worth something as well.
Mm-hmm.
So like they were helping each other, but he didn't, neither of them made it about them just having sex or just, you know, let's forget all of our troubles by being with each other. They, neither of them wanted to forget that. Like, he was still taking care of his dad. She was still taking care of her family, and they knew they needed to keep that up. They couldn't just run off together and ditch all of their family and be like, well, forget you guys. We're going to go be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I like that they didn't, like, you know how you were saying, or I've seen it as a common trope in romances where, like, the ex is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, they're going to end up with the new person, and you want them to end up with the new person.
Mm-hmm.
You knew stuff about their exes or about the people they had been with before, but it wasn't like, oh, he beat me, or oh, she was a horrible person. The one girl did cheat on him, but at the same time, it was like, but he still loves her. Like, it's not just like I forgot her about her existence
right.
because this other woman came into my life. It's like I still love that woman.
Right.
They had something serious before, so the idea that this romance between them made them actually appreciate the romances they had before was like such a weird, like, nobody ever does that. They're like, you know, I should actually kind of make my marriage work. Like, nobody ever has that in a story, and I thought that was really brilliant and really true, like, better than just saying, well, I'm going to give up then and just take this.
Right.
When instead it could be like, no, but we had something good before, too, enough to inspire all of this painful music,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, why not try and make it work?
No.
Anyway.
Yeah, because there, like I said, there's kind of a formula that you respect, and that part of it, that evil ex thing,
right.
is like, I mean, you could even put that as much as Scott Pilgrim got all this respect for being this avant-garde thing about how, you know, you can, like, in some ways, like, it seemed like that was giving young men permission to see, like, romance as a conquest,
mm-hmm.
but it was still cheaply earning this thing of, like, this melodrama over seeing romance as, like, this thing of, like, you know, I'm better than this other person, and there's a lot of, like, this self-righteousness that,
yeah.
that part of that never really speaks to me.
I forget what kid's show. I was reading a thing recently about a kid's show that had a romance in it, like a teen drama thing.
Uh-huh.
And they were going on about the trope, this kind of trope where the main female is, you know, making a choice between two dudes, and one guy is the nice guy that you've been following the whole time, and the other guy is some bully that shows up to, like, sweep her off her feet. And they're like, okay, first of all, if she's a decent human being, why would she go with somebody that they all know is a horrible bully?
Mm.
Like, that makes her look like an idiot.
Mm.
And then it also perpetuates that whole nice guy syndrome where guys just think, well, I'm the nice one. How come they don't want to be with me? I should have the right to have her because I'm the nice guy, right?
Yeah, because, like, I think if you're like me in eighth grade, you already understand a lot of the melodrama in a literary you know, artifact, then it's like, well, I was nice to two girls.
Right, so.
Two
whole female ones.
And it's like that doesn't mean that you're awarded, here is your prize.
Yeah, that's not how this works. So if they didn't do the whole, like, this makes either of them look like complete retards because they would rather pick some stupid bully that shows up midway to, like,
right.
steal them from the other person. You know, there's a whole bunch of weird romantic tropes. This is why I generally don't like romance, because they have all these stupid tropes in there that make no sense at all. But this one, I think, was a really good, accurate picture of a real relationship that they would still have as a relationship, even if they get back with their other partners. Like, they still care about each other, and they would still even make music together. And it's not like, actually, I know Lady Gaga was getting, we talk about A Star Is Born,
uh-huh.
Lady Gaga was getting a lot of flack about how romantic she looked with Bradley Cooper when they're singing together.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you don't understand what it's like to perform with somebody. That doesn't mean we're like a couple.
Right.
It just means music is a beautiful thing.
Really,
and
actors.
We're very good together. Like, yeah, this is our job, guys. Like, what do you think?
But I think something like this, to your point, it shows the beauty of portraying a relationship like this.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't necessarily rely on this kind of, like, the novelty of those types of things where there's this mutual respect, and there's this love for love itself.
Yeah.
It's kind of, like, really inspiring. And it's something that definitely came across in their performances.
Yeah.
Didn't mean to interrupt, but...
No, I'm good.
So I really dug them. I want to just go on Spotify now and start...
Yeah, I know, get all the music.
...racking up all their...
I already found the guitar book online, so we'll be working on some songs.
Hey.
It's gonna be nice.
Oh, I guess I can
Because
announce.
I love that song so much.
Oh, yeah, the Falling...
Falling
so,
Slowly.
That, I think, very, like, quintessential in it of this movie. I think it's the one kind of, like, you can't really make an excuse for it. It's like nine diegetic is that they like both know how to play the song right away.
Yeah.
But like in showing her character, it very much shows this, like this, aptitude on her part of
right.
like, oh, I just picked this up and
yeah.
You know,
I mean, if she really was, you know, taught to be concert level pianist, the chords for that song are not terribly complicated. I mean, the improvisation she just randomly comes up with maybe a harder thing, but, like, the idea that she could play along and harmonize to something is not insanely far-fetched if you're a very good musician. I could not do it because I'm not that good at anything, but, you know.
Yeah. But I think it reaches that transcendent thing of, like, this
were,
means something that
together.
They're able
yeah.
to
yeah.
to play this together right away.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful song. So, yes, find their stuff.
And I think it won best song, like best Oscar for best song.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember.
Out of like nowhere. They're like, this was a cheap movie that they made in Ireland and it got like a local award.
Uh-huh.
But then like that song got best best song and it just like blew everybody out of the water.
Yeah, I'm glad I got that,
yeah.
that honor. So quick announcement. I'm going to be at Evil Expo. January 24th and 26th. If you're like me and you plan with like spreadsheets, your full year, I'm going to talk about a little bit about more complex romances. That's going to be one of the panels I do. We're going to talk about the bad boys of
the bad
young
boys
adult.
Of YA, which is going to be amusing.
I think we're going to talk about the heroes. Do we need? I'm working on the title, but it's about like what is a hero? Because I've been fascinated about anti-heroes, and it's a big part of my fiction. So I'm going to talk a little bit about do we need heroes? I think is what I'm going to call it. So if you wanna join us, it's in Hackensack,
New Jersey, in January.
Yes.
Evilexpo.com. Run by the Dark Lord himself.
The Radisson.
You should look up the Dark Lord on Twitter. He's funny.
Yes. Yeah, Jeff Mock is the runner of the whole thing. He does the tweets about evil things. So, yeah, look that up if you're down. You have anything to plug other than... Iron Sorcerer, pre-order now.
Yes, or pre-order The Iron Sorcerer and many other stories in Kaya Knight Press, the bi-monthly magazine by Kaya Knight Publishing. You can get it on their website and apparently on Amazon and other places. So look up Kaya Knight Press and find The Iron Sorcerer.
Easy. All right, well, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you later.
Bye!